Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have we do that again. Start from the top, Mark. Good to have you all with us here on the second hour of the Mark Steiner Show. We're trying to bring you things that are very relevant to what's happening in Baltimore. That's why we had our conversation with David Kennedy in the last hour, because that is a system that is coming to the city, and we are also going to bring in a panel of people who work actively in juvenile justice in our community and in justice in our community to talk about what that would mean and how that works. So that's one of the reasons that we did that and why Paul Graziano is joining us this hour. Of course, he's the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Baltimore City and Commissioner of the Baltimore City Department of Housing and Community Development. He was appointed by then Mayor Martin O'Malley in 2000. Is that right, Paul? 2000?
Yes.
2000. And joins us live here in studio. You can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. You can log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. And we're going to talk about this project that's called RAD. That's the acronym. Started under George Bush. It was going to be a wholesale thing around the country. And it was kind of some people in Congress and others, an activist, kind of forced it back into a pilot program. Baltimore is one of those. What it means is through private equity developers, we'll be able to rehab and operate public housing. And residents will get a greater choice in the broader sense. That's what it is. We're going to talk about all the critique of that, what goes on. And please join us here at 410-319-8888. And Commissioner Graziano, welcome.
Good morning, Mark. How are you this morning?
You just slid right in time.
Yes,
that's good.
Yes, just on time arrival. Thank you for this opportunity.
I appreciate it.
I want to say one quick thing up front. It was the Obama administration, not the Bush administration.
I thought it started under Bush.
No, it was. There were different iterations that were proposed, but the demonstration by the Obama administration, but each of them was proposed by the Obama administration.
Gotcha. But didn't it configure in the beginning with George Bush when he was looking to do this, but then it was kind of pushed back, and this is kind of the reinvention of this under Obama?
It had been looked at by a variety of people in the industry, but the Obama people were the first ones that actually put together legislation and moved on this demonstration, yes.
It's here.
Yes, it is. It is.
So let me – a couple of quick questions here.
Sure.
Because you called in the show last week when we had that roundtable with Jeff Singer and Melody Simmons, who wrote the story for The Brew.
Yes.
And what I thought about after reading the Brew article and reading the Brew article again and looking at what was said between us in that very brief encounter on the program, what was it about this particular thing that the housing department – was kind of reticent to really talk about it? I mean, one of the things you said to The Brew and said to us on the air very quickly was that vouchers, they got it wrong, that it's not going to have vouchers. But then the next day in The Sun, they said it was. I mean, there seems to be...
Well, it's pretty clear. We have been talking to our residents for at least 6 months, probably significantly more than that, about this program. Probably closer to 7 or 8 months, and we'd had very extensive discussions with the residents affected in each of the sites. We'd had discussions with our employees. We certainly had a lot of discussion with HUD and had briefed the advocates on more than one occasion. But we felt, since we were still working out details with HUD, that we wanted to await a formal public announcement until we could iron out a few more details. But frankly, given that there was so much bad information out there, we felt it was no longer appropriate to wait because I think it was unduly alarming our residents and, frankly, others.
So I know that's one of the things you said when you called the show, because you thought there was a lot of misinformation that was happening on this program that day. Is one of the reasons.
Well,
it, right?
This program, but it was the lead up to that was the article in The Brew, which had a lot of inaccurate information, and so I think that it's important as we go to a broader audience, because it's not that it's been under wraps; it's been discussed with residents in 20 plus locations. It's been discussed with a citywide Resident Advisory Board of the Housing Authority. It's been discussed with the advocates, as I said, on more than one occasion. And it'll be discussed again with our advocate group, I believe, Wednesday of this week. And it's been discussed with our employees and elected officials. Many have been briefed and so forth.
It sounded like the city council, when we asked them to comment, they sounded like they were caught off guard.
Well, everybody who had RAD developments in their district was given a heads up several months ago. But we will be having a council hearing on an informational hearing on the 20th. And so we'll be happy to get further information out and answer any questions the council has.
So there are a lot of questions around this. I think people and you can kind of clear things up from your perspective as we go through this. I mean, in the country, not just in Baltimore City, but in America, and in Baltimore City, private developers rarely, if ever, create housing for poor people because there's no profit in it. So, the first question is, I know that they are getting, 110% of the fair market rate subsidized because the federal government subsidizing it, which is one of the reasons private developers are doing it. But what can we expect of this?
Well, first of all, I want to correct one misimpression.
What's that?
You are correct that private developers cannot produce affordable housing without a public subsidy because, of course, by definition, it is not profitable. So you either have to have a subsidy on the front end, which is a capital subsidy to get it built, and or, and often both, a subsidy on the back end to ensure that the rents that the tenants pay are affordable to the tenants. And that's what our programs do. And I would say that just looking at some of the other activity that we've been engaged in over the last 5 years or so, and I just happened to do this analysis, we have worked with private developers who have produced over 3,500 affordable units, and these are all private developers. Most of those are rental. Some are affordable for sale housing. And it is an expensive proposition, and it gets increasingly more difficult as the federal dollars are diminished. So, and I would also say one of the specific things that we were seeking when we did a request for qualifications for developers for this project was developers who had extensive low-income housing tax credit experience, because you're right, some guy who does luxury condos down on the waterfront is generally not going to be at all knowledgeable about that world and about the opportunities and about the requirements. So we weren't going to just convey these properties to somebody who did not know how to preserve and to operate affordable housing.
So, but the question still goes, if they're there because of the RAD rules, I mean, and even though we were talking earlier, this is an Obama idea, George Bush pushed the idea of privatization of public housing for a long time, and that was kind of stopped by a lot of forces. But if the way the federal government has diminished subsidies to federal housing over the last 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, since 1980. It's been diminished.
Exactly.
Just whittled down to nothing. So what is to say that this program now, that where you give this 110% more than the fair market rental value to these developers so they can afford to do the work they're going to do, that won't be taken away. And then those places would be completely privatized because those funds will leave. I mean
– Well, no, because there are contracts with these owners. What you're distinguishing is between new projects moving forward and projects that are under contract. And one thing I will say that in a bipartisan way, Republicans and Democrats have – historically, throughout the years, even in the lean years, have fully funded the project-based rental assistance program that we would be likely using for these conversions. In other words, both the Republicans and the Democrats look at these as contracts with private entities that must be honored. On the other hand, for some reason, even though there are contracts with housing authorities, we are routinely funded at somewhere between 80 and, if we're lucky, 90% of what the operating subsidy will be. And in terms of the capital, that's day-to-day operations. In terms of the capital side, we are light years away from the need that is here locally and the need that is national. And I just happen to have a chart here, which the Council of Large Public Housing Authorities has put together, and they're certainly very, very, very objective and analytical about this. And they say in the capital fund, the president's budget that was just submitted to Congress is $1.925 billion for capital fund nationally. What CLAFA is saying is needed minimally is $5 billion plus. And so you see you're at less than 40% nationally, even with an administration that, you know, clearly wants to be supportive.
So I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but what I'm trying to say is that given the way politics runs in America, that this program could be pulled in the next 4 or 5 years, given who's in charge of Congress, and that these houses that are owned by private developers would in fact then become
houses. In fact, they wouldn't, because they have legally binding restrictions that will tie them up for at least 40 years. And the point is that do you want to be in a place where we're already seeing the draconian cuts? We're already experiencing the draconian cuts, which is the public housing program. And as I said, I said it last week here, but I've said it elsewhere. If I didn't, we have $800 million worth of capital need. And when you look at what we have for system-wide, when you look at what we have for available resources each year, we have $4 million. That's a 200-year build-out. Obviously, that's absurd. Here's an opportunity for us to do $300 million worth of work in 2 years plus.
Well, I mean, but when you use the word, I think it was in the Sun, so if I'm wrong.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
You said that these houses for 40 years, you're just saying now, would be for low-income people. But what does low-income mean? When I look through what HUD means by low-income, low-income means 60% of the median income of a given area. So that could be people making $50,000 a year. What does low-income mean?
Mark, it's very clear. The people who are living in these buildings today, by law, must remain in these buildings, and they must the new owners cannot raise their rents. Second, when they move, the people who come off the people who they select for the new tenants must come off the Housing Authority of Baltimore City's waiting list. They can't just put together another list somewhere else. And I can assure you that the vast, vast, vast majority of our applicants are below 30% of area median income.
That's for sure.
Yes. And so if they must take those the new applicants, the replacement tenants, off our waiting list, then it is inevitable, obviously, that they will be serving the poorest of the poor.
But it's my understanding from what little I know of what people have told me of the RFP, and I've not read the RFP, but I've talked to a lot of people who have read the RFP, who have said that new tenants coming in, and maybe these old tenants, if I'm misreading it, will have to pay their utilities, which they never had to do before. So A, that's another burden on the poor, and If somebody moves out and somebody moves in and they can't prove that they can get utilities, how are they going to move in?
Well, first of all, the 30% rent burden includes utilities. So if it's not clear that the owners have or have not or would or would not exclude the utilities, but if they did, they'd have to provide a utility allowance for the tenants, which is based on the actual cost of the utilities. And that would thereby reduce the rent that the tenant paid to the landlord. So the sum of the two, any utilities the tenant pays plus the rent to the landlord, cannot exceed 30% of their income.
So this is such a huge thing. It's such a huge change in where we've been and where things are going. And I think that it just really says to me, in some ways, before I come back to this question about low-income housing credits, because it just popped in my head as you were just talking, but it says that, unlike most Western countries, the United States wants to get out of the public housing business, that we don't want to provide public housing. We don't want to pay for it anymore.
There's a lot of things that we don't seem to want to pay for, yes. And if you're asking me whether the Housing Authority of Baltimore City wants to be in the public housing business, of course we do. But we have a moral responsibility to our residents to bring those properties up to the best possible standard, and that relates to the current tenants. We also have an obligation to ensure that future generations have access to that housing. And I can assure you, without the $300 million investment, 8 to 10 years from now, if not sooner with some of them, they're going to be uninhabitable, and we're going to be moving people, and we're going to be knocking the buildings down. And so that's not something that I want to see.
Can we go to the phones here?
Sure.
410-319-8888 is the number here, as we talked to Commissioner Graziano. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner.
Thanks for calling.
At the beginning of when Mr. Gratzky spoke, I understood nothing of what you said. I would have to be a lawyer to understand that, and I think the public deserves better, you know, needs a clearer understanding of what you explained at the beginning. Also, you're taking the accountability away. My voter's card in my pocket can hold a government official or an elected official accountable for the failures in public housing, whoever that may be. But when you put it in the hands of a private industry, then you're taking the accountability for the failures of it away. Thank you.
Okay, let me try to give some real life examples, because I know numbers are sometimes, you know, abstract when you talk about $300 million or $800 million or $1.9 billion for Congress. I've talked about the J. Van Story Branch apartments, which is an 18-story building that the Housing Authority owns on West 20th Street. And it's people call it now the blue building because it's all covered with blue. It is, in fact, the exterior is being entirely replaced. The thing leaks like a sieve. It's incredibly inefficient energy-wise. We're recladding the entire exterior, replacing all the windows, the doors on the balconies, and so forth. That work alone is $5 million. For one building, we have $4 million for the entire system for 11,000 units. Now, even when we put that $5 million into J. Van Story Branch, we have about $20 million worth of additional work to do inside of J. Van Story Branch. We get into things like elevators, kitchens, bathrooms, heating systems. Just last month, for instance, in the severe cold, the sprinkler pipes burst in that building, and it flooded the entire building. It flooded the elevators. The elevators were down for 1 week in an 18-story building with seniors and persons with disabilities. The reason why it was down a week is because the elevators are very old and it's very hard to get parts. Each summer we have terrible problems with the ventilation systems and the cooling systems in that building. So those are things that affect people's everyday life. And another example was in the article in the Sun just on Friday, I believe, you had Michelle Russell, who is a resident of Chase House, talked about large chunks of brick falling off her building, and she's concerned about the building literally falling down before work can be done. There's another several million dollars of exterior work there before you get into the interior. So, again, we have, for the buildings that we're talking about, the 22 sites, $300 million worth of work. For those buildings, we only have $1.5 million per year, because you can't take all the money and put it in those. You got to put some into the other buildings. $1.5 million a year available for capital work, for major repairs. If we were to stretch that out, or to look at how long that would take, it would be 200 years. 200 years is a meaningless number. The buildings will be gone way, way before that. Now, as to accountability, these owners are under contract to the housing authority, to this, they have development agreements with the housing authority. They have agreements with the state of Maryland Housing Department, and they have contracts with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. And they have what are called tax credit investors, and the Internal Revenue Service will monitor the tax credit compliance. So there's at least whatever I just said, five different entities, four of which are public, that will be monitoring.
So, but Karen and Jessica, please do not hang up. I'm going to come to your calls after this question. If I have to take a break, we'll come to it right after the break. 410-319-8888. So, Karen and Jessica, we will get to your questions and others coming in as well as we talk to Commissioner Graziano. But again, I mean, that which just closed with Paul, it kind of begs the question on some levels again. I mean, because I know Congress can cut things, which they do. We are giving this over to half the companies are privately owned, and some are non-profit. They have a non-profit, though. That some of those non-profits are tied to for-profit companies. We saw the kind of housing crash, mortgage crash that happened that took down the economy. And if that happens again, or someone defaults on a mortgage, things go belly up. And this is a very kind of dangerous way to go. Some people argue this is a dangerous way to go about rehabbing these places. That there may be alternative ways, which I'll talk about in a minute to see what you think. But that these are real issues here. And when you talk about a private company, their motive is profit. If they can't make it, they go belly up. What happens to all the people?
There are huge, huge, huge oversights and disincentives for somebody to try to back out of one of these deals. There is no conceivable way that somebody who's in the tax credit business is going to just decide one morning, oh, I'm going to sell these off. Because keep in mind, as they do tax credit deals, and these companies are all in the business for the long haul, if they were to default on a project like one of ours, they will never be able to do a tax credit deal again. It is a system that is closely monitored, as I mentioned, by so many parties. And again, I would just say that the alternative of doing nothing is totally unacceptable.
So let me go to the phones, I promise. I have a couple of questions behind that. I mean, because I'm wondering about how a developer will be able to afford the rehab and pay the debt they incur. I mean, these are real issues. Because you're talking about companies that have to take on this debt, and we've seen what's happened in this economy. We're not the strongest economy we're not the strong economy we once were.
Tax credit deals historically, and they've been around since the mid '80s, are some of the safest investments in all of the capital markets, and the default rate in that program, even in the depths of the Great Recession. Is infinitesimal.
410-319-8888. Karen, you're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Karen.
I'm calling in reference to my 91-year-old grandmother who is in low-income housing. She currently pays $170 a month, which is a 100% increase from her last recertification. And she's received a letter that it will be going up to $550 per month May 1st.
What's her income? Where'd she get her money from?
Social Security. So her income has not changed. She's a 91-year-old. It's not changed.
And where does she live?
She lives on Eden Street in Baltimore, East Baltimore City, Eden and Oliver Street.
I see.
What's the name of the development?
I don't have the name of the development off the top of my head.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in that community, but it's public housing.
You could certainly call into my office. We can look into it because that is, frankly, just impossible that her rent could go up to $500 in a public housing
unit.
Unfortunately,
I don't have the letter with me. My mother has the letter. This is my grandmother, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
My mother can't hear this radio program, so I am calling in for her. Again, that's why I don't have the letter.
Well, if you could just call my office.
And what is your number?
410-396-3232, and just give them the information, and we'll have somebody call in on that. But those numbers are just impossible. Oliver Plaza
exactly
is not public housing, but we will certainly check and see what's going on there.
You said that's not public housing?
No, it is not.
Okay.
We will certainly also, I mean, we deal with all kinds of housing,
right,
at the housing department.
Low income, so.
Yeah, so I, but I, it hasn't, it won't be related to this particular effort, so, but we will certainly look into it for her.
Right. And if you like, Karen, if you don't hang up, Mark, or one of our producers there who's on the phones right now, can pick up and take your number, and we can actually give your number to Mr. Graziano, who can give it to the people he needs to give it to at HCD.
But I want to be very clear, and we're happy to do that, but I want to be clear that, one, that's not public housing, and two, it would have nothing to do with this particular effort. Not to say that we're not concerned about all the other housing in the city. Obviously, we are. We deal with all kinds of affordable housing.
So we're going to take a very brief break. And Jessica, you're the next caller up. And Mike, you're the next caller after Jessica. And I have at least four or five questions of my own. And we'll get through this next half an hour together with Paul Graziano. Stay with us. 410-319-8888. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're here with Paul Graziano, of course, the Housing Commissioner for Baltimore City, Department of Housing and Community Development, as well as Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Baltimore. He's been in that position for the last 14 years almost.
Almost, yes.
Almost 14 years. 410-319-8888 is the number here. We're going to come to the phones, and Jessica and Tony, we're going to you, Jessica, Tony, Mike, in that order. We'll get to your calls. There's one question somebody just sent in here. Want to know what exactly was wrong with the Brew article?
The Brew article, I think the biggest concern that I had, and I'd have to go through and look at every single point, but the biggest one was the notion that was conveyed that all of our residents in those public housing buildings would be given a voucher and told to move. And that, frankly, was reinforced on the comments that were made by the author of that article and by Mr. Singer on the air last week. And there was even reference to things like, well, there's a lot of accessible housing, meaning wheelchair accessible and so forth, in the high rises. And when these people are thrown out of these buildings, it's going to be very hard to find these accessible units in the private market. And so that, to me, was very disturbing because I don't want one of our residents to be anxious for one moment about the notion that they will lose their home.
I think what Jeff Singer said on that show was, that program, was that that there are not enough, even if you have a voucher, if you have a Section 8 voucher, there are not enough homes for people who have Section 8 vouchers. Many people are not accepting them.
Right.
That's not a solution to people's problems.
Right. But the point is these people aren't being given vouchers to move. These people
will be eligible for vouchers in 2 years, is what you said.
If somebody wants to move, this is actually an added benefit because the current residents of public housing cannot get a voucher in any number of years to move. They don't have that right. This program gives you the statutory right after 2 years to ask us for a voucher, and if we have one available, we have to give you one. And then you can use that voucher to move anywhere. By the way, if you move with that voucher, we will then backfill that apartment with another person off our public housing waiting list.
So, and we're going to come right to you, Jessica, but this begs the other question I asked earlier, and I really want to get to these other points, but which is that in the RFP, I mean, it very clearly says that any new resident is going to have to show they can pay for utilities. They have the right that'll be, and they also that if it's unaffordable, they don't have to rehab the houses of the apartments if they have disabilities.
No, that's
if
not
they cannot,
true.
If it is beyond the cost that they deem acceptable.
No, that's not true. These units that are accessible units in these apartments are units that were retrofitted at considerable expense for full wheelchair accessibility, and they must be maintained in those numbers.
Let's go 410-319-8888. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Jessica.
I work for an organization called Right to Housing Alliance, and we work with a lot of low-income tenants, mostly in private rental housing in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. And Commissioner Graziano, when you gave this real-life example of the state of public housing in some of these high-rises, you're describing a lot of the public low-income rental housing in Baltimore City. A huge amount of it is substandard, and there's virtually no accountability for that. for property managers or owners of these properties to keep those up to code, to keep them up to standard that, that everyone should be living under. So I'm wondering how you think that private developers are going to handle handle that better than the private market is handling rental housing now. Why you think that's going to be any different, why you think it's going to be a better solution, why you think it's going to provide more stability for people. That's pretty much my only question.
All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Well, we start with the fact that there'll be $300 million worth of work that will be done. If the work isn't done, the deal doesn't proceed. And so, therefore, you're going to take a building that's constantly in a triage situation, a Band-Aid approach to holding things together, to buildings that where the program requires that they be rehabbed to a standard that will be means that they will be livable for several decades, and that is a standard that really has not been available up to this point, given the dearth of funding. And I would say that landlords who participate in our Housing Choice Voucher Program are subject to very rigid inspections by the housing authority. So in those cases, we also have an ability to hold them accountable. And the same thing will be true here. The housing authority and or HUD will be inspecting these properties, and HUD working with the state of Maryland because they contract out to the state of Maryland. If the properties are not maintained, they will be maintained because of the $300 million worth of work. But if down the road there were a problem, the rent subsidy can be withheld from the owner. And so I think there are far more mechanisms under these types of programs to hold landlords accountable than there are in purely private housing. But I would also add that our code enforcement department certainly can address those issues in a purely private market rental.
So, we'll go to the phones here again, and on the way there is another kind of retort here that came through that, and I was thinking the same thing, though I didn't say it. I mean, but there was nothing in the Brew article that I read it many times, that's why I had them on the air, that was not factual. Everything in there was factual. But part of it was that it just pushed something that I think perhaps wasn't, that everybody wasn't ready to talk about just yet. I mean, there wasn't anything in that article was actually not factual.
Well, actually, there were a number of misimpressions that were given. Is it a fact that somebody could be given a voucher after 2 years? Yes. But to imply that everybody was going to be given a voucher, and the interviews that were made, I'm not here to critique Ms. Simmons and her reporting. I am here to focus, because in fact, the more I talk about that, the more confused people will get about what was there versus what. I don't consider the Brew to be the public record of what people ought to know relating to this. The facts are.
But I'm just saying. So I'm just trying to be clear. It was not the facts. The facts were not. There were no lies in the article.
There was confusion in the article, and there was a juxtapositioning of certain points and quotes that would lead people to believe that they'd have to move somewhere else, that they'd have to they'd be on their own. I'm not here to debate about the Brew.
But that's not what the Brew article said. I just want to be clear.
Well, I okay. But
let me go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning, Tony.
How are you doing?
Very well.
Yes, I'd like to talk to Mr. Graziano. I have a grandmother that lives in that J. Van Stoy building.
Sure.
And I'd like to ask him, I mean, what is the seems to be the problem down there as far as my grandmother's lived there 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the 10 years that I go visit her and look over and look out for her, I find that in that big building that they are short of help. And you've had problems, as he spoke about, on the elevator leakage and all. My question is, why haven't they given help in that building? I believe that building has something like 357 units, And I've talked to some of the guys, and it's only like three mechanics in that whole building. And the building is deteriorating from the inside out. And from what I see, they're working on the exterior before they work on the interior. And then you're talking about, I'm sorry if I'm jumping, and then it seems to me that these people's jobs are in jeopardy, and all because they're not getting the help.
Well, you raise a number of points that really make my point, which is to say there is an incredible amount of work to be done in that building. And by the way, when you do work like that, you do start on the exterior and work your way in, because if you were to go in there and replace kitchens and bathrooms and all that sort of thing without dealing with the leaks that are all over the building, you would have, and including replacing elevators and all that, you would have a serious problem of deterioration of the work that you just put into the property. So it is very common that you start with the exterior, make sure the exterior of the building is fully waterproofed, make sure that the windows are not drafty, make sure that the doors to the balcony and so forth are all airtight, and that certainly contributes to the comfort for the residents as well. There is not enough operating money, and that's the other half of it is the operating subsidies versus the capital subsidies. But there certainly is not nearly enough operating subsidy to complete all the repairs, and that's further exacerbated by the fact that there are hundreds of millions of dollars worth of work. When the $300 million worth of work are done system-wide, or when the $20 million of work is done inside Van Story Branch, you'll see that the cost of maintaining that building day-to-day will be much, much lower. The cost of operating that building, there's talk about utility costs, they will go down dramatically because there will be all kinds of energy conservation measures.
But so the other issue he raised leads to the question people are talking about. This could lead up to 200 layoffs of Baltimore City workers?
Yeah. Well, that's also an area where, unfortunately, there's been too much rhetoric and not enough of the – I mean, in the Brew article dated March 6, at 11:39 a.m., for instance, it talks about hundreds of employees could be laid off and up to 400 maintenance workers are being threatened with losing their jobs. That's just – I mean, there's only 600 employees in that entire operation, that's for 11,000 units. So – the numbers are tremendously overinflated. We've been working with our employees. We have been working with the new what will be the new owners of these properties. First of all, we have several dozen vacancies right now that we're holding off. That we're holding off purposely, or we're hiring temporary staff, and we tell them they're temporary, so that when a building is sold, we'll move people from the building that's sold to one of the positions that is either vacant or held by a temporary staff person. Second, we have a 10% attrition rate on the staff historically over time for the entire agency. And this program is going to be implemented over a 2.5-year period. So we're not talking about anything happening on the first buildings until the end of this year or early 2015. So there's a lot of time to work that out.
So is the number 200 wrong or right? Is number 200 right? Up to 200 city employees could be laid off?
There's no way that up to 200 city employees will be laid off.
How many do you think will be laid off?
I'm not going to speculate, because all of these things that I've said, in addition, the employers, the owners of these properties need to hire staff. They don't have staff sitting in a room waiting to work on a new building. Who better to work in these buildings than the employees who currently know the buildings and know the residents? So we've actually set up meetings between the union representatives and the owners of these new buildings. Each of the owners has expressed an interest in talking to our employees who work in those buildings. We are going to facilitate whatever needs to be done through our HR office to coordinate the interests of our employees and those who are going to be the new owners. But there are several options there. There's no way that there will be anything like that number. That,
so you have no sense. 50, no. 100, 160
have,
people
no,
lose
I
their
don't.
Jobs.
I don't at this point.
410-319-8888. Mike, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning.
My question is twofold. You talked about the inspection process, how current housing inspections will alleviate the infractions, code infractions, repairs needed and the like. Ironically, I just purchased a property last week where a Section 8 tenant is in place. The owner, told me that, because of Section 8 inspections, if, in fact, there were anything wrong with the property, you guys would not pay them, as you just recently said. After I purchased the property, met with the tenant at last, and she brought up the whole inspection list that's over now 6 months old, none of which has been addressed. So there's obviously a breakdown in the inspection process, something that needs to be looked into. Likewise, as you talk about a $300 million requirement to do repairs, I look back on the scope program where the city had exorbitant estimates on repair costs, most of which were often inflated 2 to 3 times the amount for which a prudent person could get it done. So is the price, this $300 million price tag, a real price tag? Because there again, where there might be a gulf, where there might be a chasm, it may not be as wide as we think. And just as there are tax incentives for people to buy, could there be a tax incentive program for investors to contribute for the repair costs? So if you address those two issues, I'll listen to what you have to say.
Thank you, sir. There's a lot of things woven in there. The fact that a Section 8 landlord didn't do his repairs is a reflection of an irresponsible Section 8 landlord in the Housing Choice Voucher Program. And I'm happy to hear that you've bought the building. I'm sure you'll be a more responsible landlord. But the two are really not the same. There are not the restrictions on the voucher program that there are on this program. There are IRS federal tax implications and so forth if these properties are not properly maintained and occupied. But as to the accuracy of the estimates, we have to do something called a physical needs assessment for HUD. We bring in engineers to look at all our property. They got they did the assessments and laid out what the needs were. When the developers were designated for each of the sites, they brought in people who did far more in-depth analysis and actually found that there was more capital need than our initial estimates. So they have to review those with their construction partners and so forth. That's all part of the process of going to the state of Maryland, who's partnering with us, to get the low-income housing tax credits. You need to be able to document the costs in order to be eligible for those tax credits. So, yes, I am confident that these costs are real.
Now, Glendora, we're going to come to your call in a second. I'm going to come back to something we talked about a moment ago in the RFP, because I'm going to get to that in a second. And Glendora, hold on. I'm going to come to your call. Some people have posited, and we talked about this, were there other ways for us to address this? In other words, the city floats, hundreds of million dollars in bonds, $564 million to be exact, in bonds over the last several years. People who invest in those don't have to pay taxes, they're abated. And that the question is, could we have not resolved this we do it for museums, we do it for, structural rehabilitation of city buildings. Why, A, couldn't we have floated a bond over a bunch of years to have begun to address this problem and allowed this to become a community land trust so it could never be privatized and sold and put on the market? That could it be other creative ways for a city to approach the question of housing for the poor rather than privatizing it and selling it off to for-profit developers?
Well, first of all, it's not the city of Baltimore, it's the Housing Authority. And the city, you said
the city can do that for the Housing Authority, though.
Well, the city doesn't have that capacity. The city has hundreds.
Why not?
The city has hundreds of millions of dollars of capital need that are unmet. And for the housing authority to go to the city, you just mentioned $564 million in bonds. Well, those bonds have to be paid off, and they're paid off with taxpayers,
property taxes, and whatever
and
else
so
come
forth.
Through. Right.
What we're talking about is $800 million worth of need. So this would be close to a third more. It would be than the entire indebtedness of the city at this point. The city's bond ratings would plummet. The cost of borrowing. I can give you a list of probably billions of dollars worth of capital needs in this city that are not fully funded.
But if we can fund things like museums, we can't fund housing for the poor.
We fund museums to the tune of a few million dollars.
A little bit more than that, but
it's really not in the scheme of things. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars. We're talking close to $1 billion, $800 million for the entire need of the authority. I'm certainly, the thing is, we have a real problem right now, and we have to deal with it. We have to deal with the tools that we're given. We can't speculate about, if we all did X, it would be wonderful, or if we all marched on Washington, somehow Congress would miraculously quintuple the subsidies or something. You know, we're not in that era. And so is it my number one choice? No. But I have a responsibility to our residents and to our future residents to preserve these assets.
So let's go to the phones here again.
Sure.
Let's call it 410-319-8888. And Glendora, you are on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I had a question.
Sure.
What is the difference between low income and affordable housing? Because I understand they are not the same.
And low income can be defined many ways, depending on who and what agency is doing the defining.
But see, this is where it's not helpful, because people keep saying that, but it's very clear. Let me be clear. There are over 4,000 residents living in these 22 sites. Every one of those residents will be allowed to stay in their buildings. Everyone must be. That is the way the federal law specifies that. And they can pay no more than 30% of their income for housing costs, which includes housing, the rent to the landlord, and the utilities. So, and these residents, and it's demonstrable, if we look and show you the rent rolls, these folks are paying on average a couple hundred dollars per month. So these are clearly the very, very low income. We're talking about, for the most part, seniors and single persons with disabilities. That's about, I believe, over 3,200 of the 4,000. So the people who are here are public housing residents. Their rents will not go up. Their housing costs will not go up. Second, anybody who is, when a unit becomes vacant because somebody voluntarily leaves, then it will be filled by somebody off that waiting list. And the waiting list, again, is almost entirely people below 30% of area median income.
We'll get to this last call here. I just go back to what we were talking about earlier. Somebody's helping producers show today, one of our producers producing this segment today. The quote came from the RFP is, "The owner is not required to make structural changes in existing housing facilities where other methods are effective in achieving compliance, or to provide supportive services where not part of the program." In other words, there's a lot of wiggle room in these things.
Not really. And again, we've already spent a lot of money making these units accessible. That's not an issue.
410-319-8888. Denise, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, Denise. Welcome.
How you doing?
I'm good. Denise, I have just one question.
Sure.
My question is, they're talking about losing jobs, but they're only talking about maintenance department. What about those that do security?
And Denise lives in one of the buildings, is what this says.
Okay. The security is the piece of it that I'm going to be honest, we have not fully sorted that out. We believe that we need to ensure full security in the buildings. There is there separate and apart from the rental assistance demonstration, we are looking at the question of security and whether or not the buildings are sold. I would expect there will be some adjustments to the security program in these buildings. So that is not – if there's one area that would likely result in some layoffs, it would be in the area of those monitors because we believe that, again, separate and apart from the RAD, rental assistance demonstration, that alternative measures need to be looked at.
So the one big thing this doesn't address, I'm curious how we address it, this is another show in itself, which will end here, though, I think, is that, you know, we're dealing with 82,000 households in the city that are at or below the poverty line when it comes to finding houses. That's what we're not addressing in this town. We're not addressing how we're going to house the poor.
Well, I don't know when you say we're not addressing in this town.
Maybe any other city either.
Well, you're right. I mean, the Housing Authority of Baltimore City houses close to 26,000 households between its public housing program and between the Section 8 program. And that is the most that we've ever housed. How long we can continue that with the cuts in Washington, I don't know. But it is, in fact, the most we've ever housed. In addition, in working with private developers on the other side of our shop, on the city housing side, we have 3,568 affordable units that have been produced, are being built now, or are financed moving forward, representing close to $700 million worth of investment over the last 5 years. Is it enough? No. Do we wish there were more? The home program, which is provides a capital subsidy for affordable housing construction, has been cut by 60%, for instance. We talked about public housing, but those programs, CDBG has been cut by 40-something percent.
So one day, I hope you come back soon, we can pick up from that point.
Sure.
Commissioner Graziano, thank you so much for joining
okay.
us.
Okay. Thank you.
Appreciate
thank
it.
You, Mark.
Reminding the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues in impacting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org. Reminding you, tomorrow at 9 a.m. on our program, Councilman Bill Henry will be here, along with a number of local housing activists, to also tackle this issue. You can join that conversation, bring your comments to the airwaves then. Reminding the Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our intern is Alex Boston. You can go to our website, steinershow.org, get all the background information we were talking about in these programs today, and click onto those. You can also download our podcast or program there, but you can go to iTunes and podcast the Mark Steiner Show as well. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.